from the Sky News Centre at 5. Two men who killed a British couple on their honeymoon in Antigua have been handed out their punishments. Canyon Martin and Avi Howell will each serve 3 consecutive life sentences for the murders of Ben and Catherine Mullany in 2008. Concerns are being raised about an airline's plan to allow people to view other passengers' Facebook profiles. Dutch airline KLM is going to introduce a meet-and-seat system so travellers can choose who they sit next to. Not everyone in Edinburgh is convinced it's a great idea.
You're basically looking at people via photograph and saying, well, they're one thing or another, and how can you do that? That's wrong. No, I wouldn't use it.
I could imagine using that, actually, because then I could avoid sitting next to children.
What right has anybody got to check you out before they travel and sit beside you?
Two Premier League footballers have been arrested after cars were damaged in Newcastle City Centre. Lee Catamol and Nicholas Bentner, who play for Sunderland, were held by Northumbria Police yesterday on suspicion of criminal damage. The first ever audit of dementia care has found hospitals need to do much better. It describes the level of care as shocking and unacceptable. That's the latest.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol, welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Easton, John Keeley. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we look at the Russian elections, the downing of a state-of-the-art drone in Iran, and a new US law which will allow detention without trial. And we hear from one of the big players in the secret government, Henry Kissinger. What's he predicting for the Arab winter? Then to Parliament Square, and in the year campaigner Brian Hoare passed away, we hear from Barbara Tucker, who's following in his footsteps outside the Houses of Parliament. And on the day Bristol City Council says it wants empty offices used for building homes, we ask a provider of food to Bristol's homeless and a squatter. Until they are built, what's the funding for the homeless hostels under threat? And we ask, what is actually funding? Where's the funding coming from for this? And will it help? We also take a tour of the city's Christmas shows with Billy Quain of BCFM's Art Show. That's in the second hour. After six, on to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 1 degree Celsius. Yes, it's pretty chilly out there, and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 5 Celsius, sunny and dry. Next week, highs of 12 Celsius, wet and windy for most of the week, a bit like last week, I guess. And next weekend, that's Christmas weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, sunny spells and showers, but windy. No snow as yet predicted. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest. Joining us is Lib Dem councillor for Easton, John Keeley. Hi, John. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi there, Tony. Thank you very much.
Now, first of all, what is your role within the City Council? What committees are you on?
Well, the main committee I'm on these days, Tony, is the Audit Committee of Bristol City Council. So I'm looking at the budgetary pressures that the council is under, which is a very big job these days, one has to say. But apart from that, obviously, I'm the City Councillor for Eastern Ward, where BCFM is actually based, I'm the joint chair of the local neighbourhood partnership that covers Easton, Lawrence Hill and Ashley.
Tell me, what kind of oversight is there of the budget that the council spends? How much do we spend every year in the city?
Around about £500 million is actually spent. That's the budget. It's an enormous budget. And there's a huge amount of oversight goes on. There are actually two committees at the council that look at the budget and the cabinet itself. And essentially what happens is the budget is released on a regular basis, to scrutiny commissions on the council, and the audit committee, for example, the one that I sit on, is looking both at the actual budgets and pressures in the budget, but also looking ahead at the risks, to the actual budget in terms of, obviously, the economic situation that we currently face ourselves in. That information is then fed back through senior officers to the cabinet, and they then make their decisions based on our thoughts, opinions and advice.
Now, you're making millions of pounds of cuts this year, so how do you make sure that your officers and staff aren't overrunning? In other words, carrying on doing the same kind of things as they were doing last year, because of course the problem is a lot of the time and energy of councillors now is actually spent on trying to limit the damage that the cuts are causing. You're not actually really able to be that proactive, are you?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a number of issues there, really. I think what we've actually done, as a council over the last a couple of years. I mean, this process, you know, it didn't just happen when the coalition came in. It's been going on for quite a while. That some of us felt that the Bristol City Council was actually, you know, not very efficient in regards to the way it actually, you know, spent council taxpayers' money. So we've actually been reorganising the council now for 2 or 3 years. That process is ongoing, and there's been, you know, massive savings, millions of pounds worth of savings that has come from that process without affecting the front line. And you know, so we are now. You are right. This year and next year are going to be incredibly challenging for the council.
Well, you say that, but for example, with home care, there is evidence that some of these privatised home care companies, rather than the council's in-house ones, really don't care that much about people, and that they keep their staff on these very, very short-term contracts, for example, and they're not. The standards are slipping, even though the costs are going down. The standards aren't being maintained.
I don't accept that. I mean, I actually, when I was executive member in charge of actually adult community care and Bristol City Council, you know, I was involved in negotiations with the not-for-profit, and don't forget, not all these people are private companies. They are not-for-profit social enterprises and the rest as well. And we met with them, and I went out with their staff, and there is no difference at all in the actual level of service and care that the you know, private home care providers, you know, the people who provide the service directly to, you know, the vulnerable people, if you like, are no different whether they work for the council or if they work for another sector. Their main focus is actually caring for people.
What about things like job security, though? Because that obviously affects someone's morale in a job. If they are only employed on a temporary basis, they're not really going to care that much about what they're doing. Whereas if they know that it's a long-term thing, that they're actually being employed, that builds up trust between the employer and the employee.
Well, that is exactly why we've actually gone for contracts, you know, with some of these other providers, so that we're actually giving them, you know, that sort of base, that they know that they've got a contract for a number of years with Bristol City Council to provide home care.
So couldn't the council give people permanent jobs or long-term contracts?
They could do. The difficulty we've got, of course, is that the department has been overspent for many years. You know, we can buy home care for around about £16 an hour. We're paying more than £30 for it in-house. And at the end of the day, we could have provided a lot more home care if we'd actually reorganised the service earlier. And nobody's actually grasped this nettle for years. We're now having to grasp it because the service is overspent. It's not the only area in adult community care where there's actually budget pressures. But there are other ways of delivering a service, you know, which makes sure that we're at least protecting the people who are getting it now, and maybe in the future when things do improve, once we've got these processes in place, we can start providing more home care. Because when I actually was looking at home care and actually, you know, changing the relationship and introducing some not-for-profit and other providers, we could have provided an extra 180,000 hours of home care. But because the unions and certain aspects within other parties were opposed to these proposals, and they were not explained properly to the public, those vulnerable people have been denied that. They could have had that for 2 or 3 years, extra home care, and they were not given it. And I refute that there's any difference between the home care provided by the not-for-profit sector and the private sector than there is by the council. I've seen it, you know myself, and we actually have contract managers who are actually monitoring these you know, other providers as well as our in-house providers.
I mean, isn't the idea of you know, these slightly at arm's length providers, isn't that a way of shifting blame? So when things go wrong, the council can say, oh, it's nothing to do with us.
Well, I don't think the council's involved, Tony, in shifting blame. I mean, what we want to do is provide the most amount of home care for the money that's available. And if at the end of the day, the actual evidence was that these people were not providing a good service to the vulnerable, and as I said, we're providing hundreds of hours of home care already, and we're not getting the feedback from our residents that these providers are terrible, that they're actually mistreating them in any way. If we did, then obviously we would have to look at it again, and maybe you're right, bring it all back in-house. But there's no evidence to support that. About 90% of councils in this country have already gone down this route. Bristol is actually very much in a minority, and we've actually paid the price for it. We've paid millions of pounds over the odds for a service, and less people are getting it.
Back to the audit committee, to what extent can the public actually get engaged in that? Obviously, they can actually go along to these meetings if they can find out where they are, but is there any way that ordinary members of the public can just scrutinise in a way what you're doing as an audit committee?
They can. If they go on the council's website, all the council's meetings are actually on the website on a monthly basis, and you can look, and you know, the vast majority of them are actually open to the public. I don't know one that isn't open to the public.
Do you have many members of the public actually coming along?
I was going to say
to audit, I would imagine nobody, you know, and that actually if one member of the public turns up to an audit committee meeting, you'd be quite surprised.
Well, I think, as you know, it's quite difficult for even me to be motivated enough to go on to the audit committee, Tony. I think the public probably would find it, you know, if you if you were having difficulty sleeping at night, I would suggest you take the audit committee report off the council website, read it for about 5 minutes, and you'll be asleep as sound as a baby. But it is important work, but it isn't the kind of work that people are necessarily, the public are interested. It is incredibly complicated and, you know, arcane, you know, the way councils do their finances. Very complicated. I mean, I don't
understand. Don't you think that the officers do that deliberately? They make these things really boring in order to try and send everyone to sleep so they can slip stuff through the committee.
I wish we'd done it over home care. No, I don't think so. I think they are complicated. I mean, you've got an organisation that's spending, you know, £500 million. And the beauty of it is that all the paperwork is published. People can see it if they really want to get involved, and they can. And there are experts out there who aren't councillors, whose, you know, opinions we value and we do hear from. But you are right. More service delivery areas of the council do have more members of the public engaged and much more interested in it, whether it be, you know, whether it be social care, whether it be housing, whether it be planning or transport, education. People are much more interested in those things because they're the things that directly affect people's lives. It is a little bit more you know, obscure being involved in the finance side of it, I have to say.
Now, let's go back to last weekend and this whole business over Euro. Now, how do you feel as a pro-European person that David Cameron, as the only leader in Europe, in the Council of Europe, has actually used his veto to veto this whole sort of Euro treaty, which actually isn't a treaty, it's an arrangement for everybody to discuss things and come up with a treaty next March. How do you feel about that? Because surely, you know, as a coalition, you should have been pushing David Cameron to sign up to it.
Well, I don't think anybody's come out with it with any glory, to be quite honest with you. I think the European leaders actually are in a state of denial. I mean, the conference they had last week doesn't address the fundamental weaknesses of the euro, which is about convergences of economies, which can't be converged. You can't converge the Greek economy with the German economy. I think it's virtually impossible to do so. You know, they're not allowing the banks to actually, you know, the central bank to create bonds or to print money. So again, I mean, the whole thing's completely pointless. And then they're allowing Angela Merkel to decide the budget of the Irish Republic. I don't see anybody accepting that. That is not a democratically accountable system, and I think most people should really be looking quite seriously at it. As far as David Cameron is concerned, I don't think anybody was surprised, you know, that his party, they're all Eurosceptics, he's got no mates in Europe whatsoever at all. It was a failure of British diplomacy that we did not actually get. There are people around that table who are concerned about, you know, the sort of Franco-German axis and wanted to do something about it. David Cameron could have led that. He didn't. He took his bat and ball home when his own party left, the mainstream Conservatives in the European Parliament. And it's been a disaster. I don't think David Cameron's got a great deal to crow about. People will realise this has been very damaging for Britain and Britain's interests. At a time when the euro needs sorting out, he could have been a statesman and come in there as an outsider and said, let's help sort it. Instead, he played the Little England card, and it was an absolute disgrace and an embarrassment. But worst of all was Nick Clegg, because Nick Clegg pretended, he agreed with Cameron, really, before the conference. They agreed the veto, they agreed the strategy, and then, you know, once Paddy Astor and others started complaining, and all of a sudden Nick Clegg flip-flops, he didn't even have the balls to go to Parliament. And I just really think it's an abdication of the leadership. If you really want to lead in Europe, and Nick Clegg said, I'm now going to fight in Europe, to the irony of being in a TV studio outside the parliamentary chamber, it seemed to me, well, I wouldn't want that person fighting for me. I think he's really let the side down, really, and he's an electoral liability.
Well, what should he have done then?
What he should have done is, if he agreed with David Cameron, and I believe that he did agree with David Cameron, he may not have agreed in the end that he wanted Britain to be isolated, but he agreed that Britain might have to use the veto to protect the City of London. Whether you agree with that or not, that's a matter for them. But having agreed that line, he should have stuck to it, because, you know, Nick Clegg's getting a reputation for changing his mind over very strategic matters. He's caused the party a huge amount of damage, but, you know, and a lot of us are very, very angry about it, and I'm, you know, personally not prepared to see the party completely, you know, sort of, you know, hung drawn and quartered over this, and Nick Clegg has to take a huge amount of responsibility. But if he'd agreed with Cameron the approach, he should have come out as he did on Friday. He cautiously supported Cameron, and then when Ashton and us were complaining in the papers that they were right to do, by the way, he then sort of flip-flopped and changed his mind over it, and that then showed weakness. And in the end, he couldn't even then go to Parliament because he couldn't face the fact that people were going to be laughing at him or worse, and I just think that's just an untenable position, I'm afraid. I think this is the worst thing as a Liberal Democrat I've seen in my time in politics, the leader of our party not being there, a so-called pro-European, to stand up for Europe, actually in the centre of Parliament. He wasn't there for it, and I just think it's inexcusable. He really wanted this veto, and he should have said so. We may not have liked it, but we'd have respected him for it.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, good time to bring you in, maybe. What do you think the fallout is of from this decision last week and David Cameron's use of the veto? Because as John was saying there, that actually even what has been signed up to may come to nothing again.
It probably will come to nothing. I mean, I get a sense of kind of despair as I look at this situation, because we in Britain are arguing about the usual Euro stuff. Meanwhile, the Europeans are still stuck in deflation mode, and the Germans have seemed determined to crush the Greek economy with no kind of quarter given.
Well, what do you mean by deflation mode?
Deflation basically is when you say, basically, it's the whole thing of we've got to cut. Now, I know the Labour leadership don't agree with this, but I don't think we should be cutting public expenditure. How we should spend the money we've got, that's a real problem. There are issues about how that should be done. We were talking earlier about the home care. There is a difference between in-house home care and outsourced home care. It's the level of wages. Yeah, that's the point. How much do we value the people who look after the dying and the sick? Yeah, and I'm not saying that the people who are paid low wages don't work hard. I'm sure they do, but they deserve better money. They all do. And the only way to
break... Of course, they'll be spending that into the economy.
Indeed. We used to know all of this stuff. There was a liberal economist called J.M. Keynes in the 1930s who was absolutely the core of 20th century economic thinking. But everybody seems to have forgotten about it. Angela Merkel has forgotten about it. David Cameron never even heard of it. He's actually playing to his own party, keeping them happy, as if that mattered, as if these nitwits in the Tory heartland have a clue. The banks are about to collapse, folks. The Treasury and all these people are running around like headless chickens because the Euro crisis is about the banking system. And it's just the people, the whole way the media presents this about the lazy Greeks versus the hardworking Germans, whatever, it's irrelevant. The City of London is completely bust. The New Economics Foundation brought out a report last week where they showed that the City of London actually costs this country. It doesn't bring in anything. When you add it all up, all the bailouts and all the taxes that they don't pay,
paying
and all the rest
taxes.
Of it,
they are paying taxes. And what David Cameron did last Friday is he acted to protect the city.
Indeed.
He's basically saying
he defined the British national interest as looking after certain hedge funds in the city. It's not even the whole city that he's looking after.
What he's saying essentially is that rather than back the European Central Bank and the Eurozone, he's going to back the city, at least as an independent British financial centre rather than the other one. He has to make a choice between the two.
You saw what Barroso said, who's the head of the European Commission. You are in the European Union. If we decide to put on a financial transactions tax, we will put it on. Now, you can decide not to come to the meeting if you like.
But he vetoed it. They can't do that in
Britain. No, this whole thing of the veto, everybody else just turned their back and said, well, we're going to do it anyway, and what are you going to do about it?
I see John shaking his head there. That transaction tax would or wouldn't come into Britain if they decide to do it.
No, it won't come in. I mean, who elected Barroso anyway? I mean, you know, he's another bureaucrat who's, you know, they're all self-appointed, all these people.
Are you in favour of the transactions tax, John? In the long run. I know it's hard to implement, but most sensible people, so long as it's
not in the interests, the sole interests of the Germans. And what I'm very concerned about is that everybody else has been told that they're acting for their own national interest when it comes to this crisis. And everybody knows that if the Germans actually would allow the European Central Bank actually to be able to create bonds, to be able to have quantitative easing if it needed, but also for the Germans to make some money available to actually balance the Eurozone out a bit more, because the northern countries have got a surplus, particularly Germany, and the southern countries are all bust. Either that, or actually for them to all agree that the actual euro should be dismantled, which I think is actually probably what's going to happen anyway. I think it's absolutely a disaster. But, you know, Angela Merkel, she's protected her national interest. I've got no time for the City of London, and I think, you know, I think Vince Cable is right to be looking at a manufacturing strategy for this country, and he's been a lot better at trying to get that moving after years and 13 years of Labour where all our eggs were put in one basket. But I do not want to see a tax put on people at this stage. We're taxed enough as it is, and any extra hurt, you know, in that sense, without it being fair across the whole of Europe, because let's be honest, the City of London is the big financial institution. It's the one the rest of them are all jealous of. It's about the only thing we've got that's actually stronger than the rest of them. And they're, you know, the French don't want it because they'd rather it was in Paris, and the Germans want it because they want it in Frankfurt. But quite understandably so, because they were all inside the euro. The frustration with them is, of course, if the City of London was in the euro, they probably wouldn't be having this big debate. But no, I don't agree with Cameron using the veto, but I understand why he did do it.
Martin, the rest of the European countries, almost all the others, are looking towards next March as a time when the European financial zone banks will be fixed, because that's what they basically signed up to. Do you think there's any prospect for that in the run-up to March?
I don't think there is. When I mentioned the financial transactions tax earlier, that we can't even discuss that. Really, it's not a feasible option. And the fact of the matter is that the banks are bust. Ed Balls was saying at the Labour Party conference that what we're going to do when we sell the nationalised banking system back into the private sector, we will use the profits to pay down the debt. And you feel like screaming, Ed, they're bust. They're all bust. The Merkel's not going to save the banks. Sarkozy's not going to save the banks. Cameron's definitely not going to save the banks. And come the new year, the banks are going down. I know the Treasury knows this because they're running around thinking, what the hell are we going to do? Unfortunately, the politicians have to work with the public, and the public, frankly, hasn't got a clue about the tsunami that's about to hit. And sadly, we haven't got the time to educate them.
Well, so what do we need to do, Martin, to actually to buttress ourselves somewhat against the tsunami? Run up the hills?
No, the only we're going to start talking seriously about what we need to do when it's hit, I'm afraid. We've had all these years.
Well, we can't wait for that.
The 13
wasted
years of New Labour, if you like. We've wasted all that time. It's too late to fix it.
I want to draw on your 4 years at Oxford here. Can you just tell us what we should be doing if we wanted to actually be prepared?
Well, the obvious thing to do, ultimately, I mean, I would suggest that instead of, say, Greece leaving the euro, is for Germany to leave the euro, because they can take the shock. And then everybody else, the southern countries, keep the euro, which will devalue against the Deutschmark. And then, but even this is very, very tricksy in this situation. We're fiddling while Rome burns. We're heading straight for the iceberg, and we're arguing about how we're going to fix it.
But ultimately, you know, do you think it's going to be possible for our elected representatives, whether they are sort of via the European Union at the Council of Europe and things like that, to be able to actually take control of the money system? No. Or is it really just simply in the hands of these private investment banks?
It is. One of the things about this so-called treaty that they've cooked up is that they've insisted that, you know, they were suggesting that the Greece should be let off 50% of its debt. And the problem with that was that would bust the French and German banks. So now they're saying nobody's going to be let off any debt. Now, what happens, as Keynes said in the 30s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And that's not political grandstanding, it's just the facts of life. This huge derivative-derived debt is definitely not going to be paid. And most mainstream politicians and most of the society hasn't taken on board that we've actually run ourselves into a cul-de-sac. And it's a very dangerous cul-de-sac, far more dangerous than the 1930s. And, you know, it's hard to explain to people what a mess we're
in. Can't you, from your Oxford education, Martin, show us a little light at the end of that dark cul-de-sac?
Well, the light is having a sensible discussion with sensible people, which is what we always try to do on this programme, whatever party people are in. I'm afraid we've got to raise our game as a country. All of our political parties have got to raise their game, because people are losing faith. Yeah, they're losing faith because it looks as if the financial oligarchy and the military-industrial complex are going to run us into the ground. And the elected politicians are just window dressing. And if the elected politicians want to be taken seriously, I mean, I look forward to a Conservative government that was going to give the City of London what it deserved, because it's very hard for anybody else to do it. They're their people. They've got to discipline them. And they're just not prepared to do it. It's quite obvious. Their paymasters are right there. And these paymasters are fraudulent.
I mean, one thing, for example, might be the use, the actual use of the shares that the government, the Treasury, now has in the nationalised banks, such as RBS and Lloyds.
The whole strategy was we're going to be arm's length on this, because the private banking system is bust, but we'll chuck a load of public money at it so that they can pretend that there's still a private banking system, carry on doing things, and the government won't get involved. Now, when the crash comes, people are going to realise that the only force which can actually break this is government intervention. We're not going to abolish the free market, but by God, it's going to be a much, much smaller figure than it has been over the last generation.
Well, we had some bad news this week on unemployment on Wednesday. Youth unemployment stays above a million. UK unemployment hits a 17-year high. That's going back way before, even before the last Labour government, back to the last Conservative government. Public sector is losing 67,000 jobs just in 3 months. The private sector is adding 5,000 over the same period, and the claimant count rise is less than feared, though. So we've had 67,000 jobs lost, John, in the public sector, and 5,000 in the private sector. It's not good news for
5,000 created in the private sector.
For the coalition, is it?
Well, I don't think anybody was going to suggest for 1 minute that it was going to be a walk in the park. I mean, you know, we've actually inherited the worst financial situation in a generation. I mean, Martin was talking about the 1930s there, and nobody thinks that's a strange thing to be talking about. When you imagine what the 1930s was like, I mean, we're nowhere near that at the moment. But you know, unless governments actually do get a grip on their financial aspects, and let's be honest, I mean, George Osborne has been a washout. I mean, virtually everything he's predicted hasn't happened. The things they said they were going to do, they haven't really done, and they're really struggling. And a lot of people felt that he was actually quite weak as a shadow chancellor, and then sadly he's proved to be just as bad as chancellor, in my opinion. So no, it's not good. I mean, the only thing, you know, the silver lining, I suppose, if there is one, is the fact that over the year the amount of public sector jobs, you know, against the private sector ones that have been created is virtually balanced out. And of course the West Country, where we are, has actually fared a lot better than others. And one of the arguments that the Liberal Democrats on Bristol City Council, for example, have been putting to the government, Barbara Jank and others have been up to London to meet with them, is Bristol is an economic powerhouse. You've got cities around this country, but we need to be freed up to the thing about a lot of European countries. If we go back to Europe, the Germans, is that their their state parliaments and their regions are much more free in terms of raising taxes, in terms of economic regeneration, in terms of decision making. We are still, things are beginning to improve, but we are still very much a centralised state here. And if you do not free the wealth creators, like in the Bristol sub-region, if we were to free them more, they would be able to do more to help drive our economy forward. And there are other cities around the country, I think, feel exactly the same. So we've been having these conversations, with Cameron and Osborne and Cable and others, and we are getting a sympathetic hearing. I mean, they've made quite a lot of money available for transport, in the enterprise zone, and maybe the Green Bank may come here as well. But really, these are just sort of picking at the edges. We need to be much more dynamic now if we're going to actually deal with this. But no, on the face of it, I mean, I've been made unemployed 3 times in my life. I've been made redundant, in those cases. It's not a nice feeling for people. I feel sorry for the youngsters, obviously, starting out and not having a job, and something's got to be done, to do with it. And I know I'd watched Parliament last week where the government did say they're going to do whatever they can to help you with unemployment. Whether it's just rhetoric or not, I hope not, because we don't want to get to a situation where there is actually no hope for people. That would be really terrible. So my heart does go out to them.
Well, Marina Morris is with us. And Marina, you've got a report this week on David Cameron's answer to these disastrous unemployment figures, and that is, and also just general poverty and child poverty, to plans to create a network of troubleshooters.
Yes, hello. In a speech yesterday, Prime Minister David Cameron outlined plans to create a network of troubleshooters to give more focused support to England's most troubled families. Under the government's measure, families need to meet 5 out of 7 criteria, including truanted children, parents with addiction, and antisocial behaviour, to be classified as troubled. Mr. Cameron claims that the state spent £9 billion last year on 120,000 families, or an average of around £75,000 per troubled family. He says that the last government has overseen a vast disjoint social and welfare bureaucracy of 28 or more state services, including the police, social workers, probation offices, housing offices, the court, and many others. Expenditure since May 2010 is, of course, under the stewardship of his government. The government is committed to providing £448 million, or around 5% of last year's state spend, on these families during the lifetime of his parliament to transform the lives of these families. The money has been found from the existing budgets of spending departments, and will be provided through a system of payments. By the result, the central government paying 40% and council being expected to provide the other 60%. He does not mention who will underwrite the risk of the cost exceeding the price that government is prepared to pay for meeting these targets. But presumably, this will be either the council or service provider, whether this is the council itself or the voluntary sector. Cash-strapped local councils are unlikely to welcome new demands on these resources. This issue is likely to be whether existing service provision can be configured or restructured to meet the requirements of the match funding. Labour ministers are claiming that the underlying work is very similar to family intervention projects, which have been substantially cut back to deliver spending cuts. In my opinion, the big challenge to troubleshooters is the need to change the moral compass and ethic values of these families and explain to them that our basic needs as a human are to have a quality of life and work towards giving our children better prospects than their parents. Empathy is a key to a better life for all and demonstrating the advantages of conforming to society's norm. In an environment of high unemployment, spending cuts and limited opportunities, substantial reduction in this number of troubled families will be difficult to achieve. What is, however, guaranteed is work for government accountants.
Okay, thanks, Marina. John, and one of the things I was seeing from some of the coverage of this yesterday was that actually local authority is going to be expected to contribute roughly half towards these troubleshooters. So is there any real substance to this, or is this just a bit of conservative public relations?
No, I think there's a lot of substance to this, and Bristol City Council is actually already a national leader when it comes to this kind of intervention with problem families as it is. So, I mean, I don't see that there may actually necessarily be any extra spenders just for those people who are already doing it. I think it could be a problem for councils that maybe haven't got this kind of already bespoke service available to it.
Well, also, we're hearing that a lot of these kinds of services are being cut, so it sounds to me as if it may be giving with one hand and taking away with the other.
Well, I suppose the counter-argument to that is, I mean, you know, they've had all this money spent, £9 billion spent on them over many, many years, and it doesn't seem to have had a great deal of effect, so maybe it's not the money that's the problem, it's actually the culture and the way it's dealt with that's the problem. I don't see, per se, that just making some kind of link worker responsible for a family and, you know, getting them to sort jump through flaming hoops, if you like, is in itself going to resolve this problem, because it's actually much more fundamental and deep-rooted than that. That's part of the solution, and I think it's important. You know, a lot of us have been very, very conscious that there's been far too many professionals going through the front doors of all kinds of individuals, particularly in this case, the vulnerable problem families. Lots of people going through, nobody taking an overview, nobody taking responsibility. You've seen that actually with cases where, you know, children have been assaulted, abused, and murdered. You think, well, there's been hundreds of people gone through the front door of this family's house, seeing all these things, and yet not one of them has taken the overall responsibility to say, well, something's got to be done. And it's very similar with this, you know. So to have a link person, I think, you know, will help some of these families, but you really have to look actually holistically at the wider environment that these people are living in. And it's all very fine dealing with them, but what are the other kind of temptations or problems that society and that community may be facing, and what is the government and the council and others doing to kind of addressing that?
But what is it then? Because this is the root of the problem you're talking about.
But you're
about,
never going to resolve this problem. You're always going to get people who, for lots of reasons, go off the rails. I think that the issue for me, I suppose, is, you know, particularly for children who were born into a situation they never asked to be born into, to see if there's anything could be done to kind of intervene to help them. I think for some of the others it may be too late, and they may be just too dysfunctional anyway. You know, and people do live, some people live very dysfunctional lives. It's very easy for people who are, you know, very level-headed and conscious and, you know, whatever, to think about these things, you know, from a kind of a middle class perspective, if you like. But you've got people on drugs, you've got people poverty, you've got people poor education, you know, you've got people who have, you know, have other sort of mental health issues. These issues are really quite complex. They're not straightforward and easy. But I do, in principle, support the policy, because Bristol has been a leader in the country of this policy already, you know, working in a positive, proactive way with these families, and a lot of these families have welcomed it, and it really has improved. Anyway, go on.
Martin.
Well, I mean, I haven't looked at the detail of this initiative.
Did you listen to Marina's
report? I did hear what Marina said, yeah. I come back to the problem is if you get the macroeconomics wrong, we've got 1 million unemployed under the age of 24. As things stand, those young people have got no hope whatsoever of starting families and settling down. And they are being drawn willy-nilly into the black economy. You can be sure of that. And, of course, as the banks collapse, we're not just going to have 1 million unemployed under the age of 24. It's going to be a lot more than that. And I don't think it would be any different if we had a Labour government. I'm not kidding about that. It's a real mess. But we've got to start talking. It's not just the culture that's wrong. We used to have a full employment culture in this country from 1945 until the mid-70s. Everybody, when they left school, was rather boring, a bit grey, a bit dull. But everybody, when they left school, had something to do. And in Scandinavian countries like Norway, they still have something to do. What did they do right and we did wrong? Well, you can ask yourself that question. The City of London, we're talking about them earlier, ultimately they have been a disaster for this country. We'd have been better off without them. Unfortunately, we've got them. And it's our responsibility in this country to discipline them on behalf of the rest of humanity. And we've got to get in there.
But I mean, is there any prospect? I mean, we're getting back to what we were talking about before. Is there any real prospect of the Treasury, that is to say our financial representatives, people we elect, actually dealing with the city and making the money system serve us? So in other words, money is there to oil the wheels.
They are incredibly weak because they are bust. And if we had politicians with some backbone, they'd be reading them the Riot Act a long time ago. And it's not New Labour and it's not the Coalition. And the people out there are going to demand that something is done. And in the periphery of the country, of course, where you've got the SNP and Sinn Féin breathing down the necks of the mainstream parties, all of the three leaders of all the three devolved assemblies, including the Democratic Unionist Party, have signed up in absolute opposition to the cuts policy of the current government. So we've got a situation where Peter Robinson and the DUP are standing to the left of you, John. That's where they're standing. And I'm really pleased to see them there.
Well, they're probably standing even further to the left of the Labour Party, who are the most right-wing government we've had actually in a generation. The fact is, Martin, the socialist utopia, you know, you nobody else supports it. And the fact is, I mean, the French, who have a much more kind of, you know, socialist model in their country, seem to be more involved in regulation. They've got higher youth unemployment than this country's got.
What about Norway? They don't have
the City of London. Well, you can pick out Norway. I mean, Norway's got, you know, massive natural resources. It's got oil. It's also got hydroelectric power, which is exporting to the whole of Europe. You know, the Germans have got massive unemployment. The French have got massive unemployment. The Dutch have got massive unemployment. The Italians have got massive unemployment. The Irish. Everybody else has got massive unemployment. So, yes, it would be nice. I agree with you. I think we should be ensuring that people have got something constructive and positive to do with their lives. I don't like people being thrown on the scrap heap as much as you do. But the sad fact of life is that everybody's following this model at the moment. And, I don't see how the country can afford the full employment you talk about without creating a socialist sort of a system which Vladimir Putin appears to be doing quite well in Russia at the moment.
Now, the communists got 20% in the Russian election. We'll talk about that later. They are the main opposition to Putin, and eventually Putin will fall and the communists will win the election in Russia eventually.
Putin is a communist.
He's not a communist, he's the KGB.
Okay, anyway, Martin,
you invoked the spectre
of the City of London there on Monday's Panorama, how to survive the meltdown. We got a rare view of one of the bosses of Goldman Sachs sitting in the top of his massive City of London office block, entirely unperturbed by the protests going on at St Paul's. Jim O'Neill is the chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management.
We think we are probably less than a quarter of the way through the most remarkable growth of middle classes on a global basis that the world will have seen for certainly many decades, if not centuries. We reckon by 2005, through for the next 30 years, there will be 3 billion people entering the global middle class. This is extraordinary.
These extraordinary places are collectively known as the BRIC countries. That's short for Brazil, Russia, India, and of course, China.
Over the next decade, their likely growth will be about the same as another one of them today, so another 13 trillion. And that will be close, if not more than double, the likely contribution to global GDP, double of the US and Europe put together. Germany now exports more to the BRICS than it does to France. Here in the UK, by contrast, if you add all the BRICS together, we export about the same to them as we do to Ireland. And Ireland isn't our most important export market.
That was a clip from Monday's Panorama. The reporter was Adam Shaw. It was called How to Survive the Meltdown. And the chap you heard there was Jim O'Neill, who's chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management. He was relaxing in his chair. He looked actually as if he was recently out of jail. There's a sort of stubble, and he was a slightly spivvy kind of character. But anyway, Martin, he's really there saying that basically we're suffering in Britain because there's actually a boom in the middle class going on in the rest of the world. 3 billion people going from the working and lower and peasant classes into the middle class around the world.
The Chinese economy is softening. They are about to have a hard landing. Shanghai has got a massively overpriced property market. And when their export markets collapse, as our banks go down, the Chinese economy is going to go down, and there's going to be a revolution in China. The working class has got to fight wherever they live, wherever, whatever government they live
in. So you're denying that there's all these people becoming middle class in other parts of the world?
It's a fantasy world that they're living in. Fantasy world. Look at the figures. The Chinese economy is about to crash along with the rest of it. And they say, well, in 5 years' time, there's going to be all these middle class people. And what are we going to do? We've got to get in there and sell them stuff. They're living in cloud cuckoo land. Goldman Sachs is a vampire squid on the face of humanity, as Matt Turby describes them. They're a criminal gang. They should be in prison. Never mind on Panorama telling us about the middle class.
Okay, John, what are your thoughts about this idea that maybe the reason we're suffering in Britain here and obviously in other parts of Europe, particularly Greece, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, it's actually people in other parts of the world like India are doing very well, 3 billion becoming middle class in those BRICS countries.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't new. I mean, I tend to agree with quite a lot of what Martin said about Goldman Sachs, by the way. but maybe I'll not put it in as strong as terms.
So why are we jailing somebody who sold a firework from a burger van and not these people from Goldman Sachs who are ripping us all off?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And I think they should actually be in front of a jury personally, because, I mean, they've hurt so many people, and, they've been...
In front of a jury for what, though? What kind of crime have they actually committed?
Well, they've sold people... mortgages that were unsustainable to start with. I mean, that's the first crime.
Deliberately.
Yeah, but that's up to you. When you sign on the dotted line for your mortgage, that's up to you to sign it.
Yeah, but they then passed on these mortgages to actually other financial institutions like Northern Rock, for example, which have greatly overinflated. So, there's a lot of issues, really, in regard to that. But, getting back to the middle classes, I mean, I don't buy the whole meltdown thing that Martin sort of obviously, really believes, although obviously I do respect his sort of experience and opinion in these things. I think the issue really has been all along is that that we've overconsumed on credit in the Western world, we need to rebalance that if we could have any hope. I mean, in the short term, yes, there may be more financial problems ahead. You're certainly looking at the euro, where they've still got their head in the sands. That's potentially the case. And the Americans got a massive imbalance actually in trade with the Chinese. And here, as I said, people in this country have bought. They've bought mainly on credit. They've run up big bills. It's been the credit crisis part of it that's been, and it's been at the root causes. So we've got to find a way of actually, exporting again, not borrowing, and spending beyond our means.
So why don't we see a really strong industrial policy? For example, we're now talking about building houses all over Filton Airfield, which is a potential massive industrial site.
Well, I don't agree that there isn't.
I mean, if we want to export, we've got to make things.
Well, I think that is happening. I mean, the Liberal Democrat part of this coalition, by the way, through Vince Cable, who I have a huge amount of respect for, is doing exactly that. Yeah, we came into a situation where a party that's not been in government for 70 years, and doesn't it show sometimes, sadly, but we have come in to try and resolve what's been a systemic failure actually of British economic policy for a generation, it's not going to happen in 5 minutes, but it is beginning to happen. Vince Cable has visited this region now on a number of occasions, and he's always visited manufacturers, and he's always asked them what they want. As far as Filton Aerodrome is concerned, I mean, I am concerned that they actually are selling it for housing. Do we really want any more housing, on that site? But as an airfield, was it really, commercially viable? I don't know.
Certainly British Aerospace, BAE Systems, we should call them, were saying that they couldn't make a profit. And then some bright spark decided to do a search on the company's house or whatever to find their accounts, and found that actually they were making a profit. But it just was that they could make more of a profit by selling it to developers.
Well, I think the issue was that they weren't making a profit in the years before that, and they made a profit in the year the person checked. But that doesn't get away from the fact that I think that's a very bad decision. I think we've allowed far too much
residential development going on. I mean, you know, this sub-region is a powerhouse actually of, you know, of industry and economic output. We must protect all that, building loads more houses. I mean, where are these people going to get jobs, you know, if they're just going to be a load of houses on a site? I think it's very short-sighted. South Gloucester Council's always been pretty short-sighted anyway. I mean, from the days they built, you know out of Cribbs Causeway and all the rest of it, you know, they've just wanted the concrete over the whole of South Gloucestershire. I mean, it's a very dull place, to be quite frank with you, anyway, and the only thing they've got is the Northern Fringe, and now they're undermining that. It's a very bad decision on their part, in my opinion.
So, Martin, is there any prospect of an industrial policy, of industry, and us being able to export?
I think the problem is that once you've been out of being a manufacturing country for a long time, as we have, because successive governments basically have danced to the city's tune. I mean, Brian Gould, for example, years ago, he said to the Labour leader...
He was
a New Zealand guy, but he was one of the founders of...
He was the deputy leader of the Labour Party.
And what he said to John Smith and the others, he said, if we're not prepared to take on the City of London, we're all wasting our time. And John Smith went off on the so-called prawn cocktail offensive to suck up to the city. And at that point, Brian Gould, to his great credit, said, well, you're not serious, folks, I'm going home. And he's a head of Waikato University now in New Zealand. And of course...
Does it surprise you then when people are not voting Labour?
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Because
not at all.
And actually aren't voting at all. When we had a by-election last night where the actual vote was down to about 30% from memory. And we've got a massive feeling out there.
This is a
After the Second World War, loads of people would vote at general elections and in by-elections. Nowadays, people think, well, what's the point?
Well, as you know, what's happened is there's this general denigration of politics as a concept, and they're all the same and all that stuff.
So you're saying
John will know, politicians are not all the same.
Are you saying then that the city has really taken over where the politicians have left off?
We are moving, like in Aristotle's Politics, he talks about what happens. You move from democracy to oligarchy. That's what happens. The wealthy classes basically, step by step, undermine the democratic setup. And that's what's happened. These Goldman Sachs people put in charge of Italy and Greece without any votes at all. If they had to stand in an election, they would be thrashed. There isn't going to be an election, and the policy is going to be decided in Brussels, which is going to be decided by the banks. Now, at some point, people are going to wake up and realise who's running this country. It's the Pentagon and Wall Street. And it doesn't matter who we elect, Nick Clegg, Ed Miliband or Cameron. It's not going to make a blind bit of difference.
So you're saying people shouldn't vote?
I'm saying that we've got to go to the people in the grassroots and say, look, we've got to get our act together and make what we want stick, and we've got to have a vision. And it's not about we've got to cut back and this way. For example, we ought to have a citizen's income for everybody, whether you work or not. Milton Friedman talked about this in the 1960s. We've got the resources to do it. We've just got to have the will to do it.
Okay.
We've got to inspire people. There's no reason at all for us to cut our own throats here.
Okay,
we want full employment, and we're going to get the money to pay for it from Goldman Sachs and all the rest of them.
Okay, before we get off the subject of money, Marina Morris has been out on the streets of Bristol this week to find out whether you approve of David Cameron's use of the veto to keep Britain out of the so-called European Financial Rescue Plan.
Did David Cameron make the right decision to veto the European Finance Treaty?
I think we should go in with the European community, be a part of it and not isolated. I just think we've been there for so many years now, I think we should be pulled together as one whole big nation and not be individualised.
At this present time, I think it might have been wrong, because there's a need to sort of maintain the value of the euro against the dollar just for the sake of the rest of Europe. The dollar doesn't destroy Europe. I think we need to support the euro just on the basis that, it's about people's welfare at the end of the day.
Oh, I don't pay attention to politics. I hate David Cameron.
I'm not into politics that much. I think he did to protect the sovereignty of England and the people who live in England. I don't think it's true that Brussels having so many rights over the people in England, so I think it's correct that he did do that, yes.
It's not a good idea to just back away from communicating with everybody else. You should all talk together and come up with a solution together.
Will the new bank prime ministers in Greece and Italy run their country better than the elected politicians did?
I think they've got a hell of a legacy to carry forward, and I think it'll be very much of a struggle because they're still going to come up with the same problems. They're still going to have to do austerity measures, and I don't see how they're going to do that, really. I mean, it's going to be a struggle, whatever.
Italy needed to get rid of Berlusconi because, at the end of the day, Mr. Unga Bunga, very colourful, but I don't think he's really, gives a damn about, the masses in Italy. He's sort of, needless to say, another billionaire, sort of plutocratic individual that cares more about his own wealth than anything else. lot of people have power to do with economics who have little or no understanding of the nature of it. So perhaps Italy and Greece will be improved. I hope that it will just provide enough public confidence that there will be less aggression amongst the poorest. I do think it might improve Italy and Greece's chances, and I think it might make for a stronger euro.
I can only say yes. I think they can only do a better job than what the previous ones did. I don't know much about the EU, but I know that it wasn't a particularly good way, and that the rest of the countries in the EU had to bail out Italy and Greece.
For who? If it's for the rich, probably yes, but I don't think the poorer will be better off.
Can the UK survive independently from the European Union?
I suppose it could, but I would prefer it to be part of it and get to survive as a one whole nation.
But I do think the UK will survive independently from Europe if it needs to. But I also hope that, like, this conservative liberal government is sort of got out of power as quickly as possible and we have some kind of real socialism in this country.
Only time will tell that. I'm not quite sure. It's a big ask for England to be by themselves, and they seem to... It's going to be hard for them just to be solely independent from the rest of the EU, so I can't answer that question, but it'd be very hard for England to be by themselves when the rest of them are united.
No, because we are too small a country to be able to survive on our own.
Well, ideas from both sides, particularly... was that John?
We need French aircraft carriers to carry our planes on, apart from any girls.
Okay. Yes, so we've got views from both sides of that. Martin, what are your thoughts about what you just heard?
Well, I'm afraid that the debate about Europe is very much... It's done in terms of stereotypes.
So do you think
do we like the French or not?
Media have been steering the debate here?
I think they have. I mean,
away from what we really need to be talking about.
I do indeed. People talking about bailing out Italy, Greece, and so on. What we're talking about is bailing out the banks, which are owed money by Italy, Greece, and so on. But the way the media presents it, it's, oh, the Italians owe the money. No, it's the banking system is being underpinned. And step by step, the banks which are bust and have been bailed out by the taxpayer are taking over the political process. So instead of the banks being nationalised, the state is being privatised by these special interests. This isn't free market capitalism. Under free market capitalism, the banks go down. When you lend somebody money under free market capitalism, if they don't pay you back, that's your lookout. But this isn't free market capitalism. When they lose... they want to be bailed out, and everybody else has got to lose their nursery schools, their home helps and all the rest of it to bail them out. And of course, it won't work. Austerity will not work. It will not reduce the deficit. And this is going to be absolutely clear in the new year. There's going to be a crash.
So,
we
John,
haven't had a crash yet,
John,
but we're going to have one.
Do you get the sense that, I mean, not rather than from a Bristol point of view, from on a national scale, that people are seeing this whole thing as really unfair, and you're going to get really trounced when it comes to both the next local elections next year and in a general election?
Well, I know there are no local elections in Bristol, but there are obviously some elsewhere. And I think the party is actually really quite nervous now. We know we have a leader who's an electoral liability. He's taken what is one of our strongest suits, a bet not being one of our most popular policies, but we've been consistently pro-European as a party. And he's actually taken that and turned it completely on its head and made us look weak, vacillating, irrelevant, a laughing stock. And I think it's quite unforgivable, really, and that he's still leader. I've got no idea. Obviously, isn't a contender for the job, because there was. I would have expected
what about
by now.
What about Vince? I mean, and also Charles Kennedy, he was sort of bounced out because he had a few drinks, apparently. But then, as Martin's pointed out on this show before, Winston Churchill got us through the war and he had a drink or two.
Yeah, but the trouble is, that Charles wouldn't turn up to things and people were starting querying, he's on the bottle again. And, you can't really do that. I mean, I'm very fond of Charles Kennedy, as a person. I've met him many times and I worked for him, actually, when I worked for the campaigns department. He was.
So what about Vince then?
Vince, I think, would make a great leader. I think Chris June, if he didn't have these other things hanging over him, which the media are obsessed with, they seem a bit more independent. The trouble with Nick Clegg is him and Cameron are incredibly similar. They come from the same background. They've got quite conservative instincts from what I can see of it. And at the end of the day, Cameron has actually played a blinder every time with Nick Clegg, whether it's over the tuition fees, the AV and this. He's played a much better game. But I do disagree with Martin. If the banks fail, it's the depositors of the banks, actually, that I worry about, what happens to those poor individuals.
They lose their money, like in Argentina.
Well, yeah, but that's not good. I mean, in the end, what we end up then is a depression, people queuing at a soup kitchen, and I don't think any responsible person would want to see that.
It's going to happen anyway.
Well, I know you've got this doom and gloom thing about you today, Martin. I can see
it's the last year or so.
It's every week.
last year or
something. Well, okay, it was just last year. So he's been predicting this downfall, you know. But I don't know what his solution to the problem is, apart from creating a communist state, you know, or a socialist state as he sees it. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Europe has failed to address the key issues in regard to the euro, and the conference last week didn't actually address the issue.
Okay, on to another story, anyhow. Now we've had our Vox Pops. And the police in Britain are deemed untrustworthy compared with Europe, says a study. Police service corruption is not endemic, the report finds, but that doesn't mean to say there's not lots of it. Geographic variables of integrity, and the action was urged over the police. That was the headline on politics.co.uk. So we had lots of different sort of spins of the headline from different news organisations. But anyway, analysis shows repeated stop and search tactics have had catastrophic effect on public trust in the UK police forces. Unsatisfactory police contact with the public as eroding trust as law enforcers and law enforcers legitimacy in the eyes of the community. And we had a report last week along a similar vein, saying that, that there was a sort of lowering of trust in the police. John, what do you think we can do to just make sure, because we're going through a lot of changes as well at the same time as this is happening. They're saying that they're talking about bringing in a police commissioner for the whole of the Avon and Somerset area.
Well, I think bringing in the police commissioner would be an absolute disaster. I mean, you'd probably get some Tory businessman who doesn't really understand the inner city or council estates, actually.
I suppose we're going back to what you were saying earlier, that there's too much centralised control in Britain, that the local authorities aren't left to their own devices to do this kind of thing. They're just told what to do.
Well, I think that's the big problem. And, you know, you're politicising the police force, which I think would be an absolute disaster. You'd have somebody, you know, about a year out from the next lot of like police commissioner elections, actually looking for nice political headlines as opposed to solving murder. Crime, you know, and what I worry about is, you know, the major crime area actually in the Avon Somerset area has been Stapleton Road, and you know most people who ran Stapleton Road, with the greatest deal of respect, would not probably be voting Conservative, but I would imagine because of the boundaries of the police commissioner, probably would be a Conservative. That's just why the Tories want it, really. It's the only way they can get power, is actually to gerrymander elections to help, you know, help themselves to very large salaries and all the rest of it. But this person would then be, you know, a year out from elections, would he or she be really interested in actually focusing on the real issues of Stapleton Road, or would they be looking at Nev Frubwell to find out, you know, people having their bikes stolen because they might get a few extra Tory votes for doing that? It's an absolute disaster. There's no evidence that this is.
From what you're saying, it sounds like we could end up with kind of ghettos with a Conservative run police force and the poorest of areas being almost unpoliced.
Well, I think that's quite a danger. And if you look at, you know, any politician, whether it be the Mayor of London or whatever, they're always, you know, even a political party will be the last 6 months before an election, they're always looking at, you know, eye catching initiatives to get themselves in front of. But, you know, when you're on the pitch, it's so important to ensure, you know, you have that continuity of service, that things have been dealt with. And if the police commissioner thinks, well, there's no votes in this particular issue for me, I won't bother, even though this is really important because we're talking about public safety and public confidence, you know, we must ensure that those things are paramount. There's been no drive for these police commissioners from any, not one person I've ever met in my entire life thought, oh great, let's have another fat cat bureaucrat, you know, former business millionaire who probably doesn't pay any taxes in this country, being our police commissioner.
Martin, finally with you, this is being presented in a way, this as a solution to some of the problems with the
police. We're talking about the police commissioner.
And also the fact is that this report is saying actually the Metropolitan Police is by far the worst for at least alleged corruption anyway in the country, not places like Avon and Somerset.
Well, I can see the situation we're in. The poor communities and the police have got to be show solidarity with each other, and that means both sides have got to be on board. And having elected police commissioners, it politicises the police. It's completely wrong. I hope they're going to be happy to have a Sinn Féin police commissioner in Belfast who have his priorities. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's it. It's coming up to the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Easton, John Keighley. After the news, we look at the Russian elections and much more.
BTFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky.